Wednesday, January 28, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the governor of Indiana is starting up a state-run news agency designed to compete with local media. Or maybe not. We'll talk about how that's come about this last couple of days. A San Diego gangster rapper is looking at some serious prison time for his song lyrics. And we're going to add to some of the Super Bowl hype as we touch on the coverage of Deflategate, NBC's day-long broadcast extravaganza that's planned for Sunday, and what we're already seeing of the Super Bowl commercials. But let's start with the hype over that East Coast blizzard.
And it's Snowpocalypse Monday.
Say it ain't snow.
The second hashtag would be Snowmageddon.
Are you ready for Snowmageddon? We're going to cuddle up with Chris.
Call it Snowmageddon, Snowpocalypse, whatever. A blizzard, if you haven't heard by now, is coming this way.
Sure, there were a few feet of snow predicted, and sure, the state and local governments set out to protect the people, urging them to stock up on supplies and issuing travel bans. And by late Monday night, the streets of New York City, like others in on the East Coast, emptied out. Well, kind of.
I'm Don Lemon in the Blizzardmobile, CNN's Blizzardmobile, and we're out showing you what's happening in Manhattan live as it happens. I want to show you this. This emergency alert just came over on the cell phone, and it says all non-emergency vehicles must be off all roads in NYC by 11 p.m. until further notice.
Yes, irony of ironies, that's CNN's Don Lemon in CNN's branded Blizzardmobile. Driving through the streets of New York, telling people not to drive in the streets of New York because it's not legal. When health and safety is at risk, you really can't blame the mayors or the governors who issued these travel bans and shut down public transit, but the hype.
Don Lemon, okay. I think we're going to have a weekly segment
The weekly segment of Don Lemon Did What?
It's almost his own parody of the parodies about him. It's just gotten to be that ridiculous. And CNN's coverage, like a lot of the cable coverage, they did air on the side of Armageddon, okay? Now, I have to tell you, I had a little bit more than passing interest in the story because my oldest daughter lives in Boston.
Where some of the highest snow totals were.
Right. But, you know, you wouldn't know that from watching them driving around the streets of New York, where all of the media, you know, hub is. And so what I ended up doing, actually, was going to New England cable news on my laptop and beaming it to my television, watching it that way, because that's how I knew what was going on with my daughter, not watching this crazy cable coverage on the national networks.
Yeah, it was sort of funny. I was flipping channels just to see what everyone was doing, because I knew we were going to be talking about it. And I clicked on the CNN just as they were talking about the Blizzardmobile, and I just...
I'm sorry, I still laugh every time I hear the words Blizzardmobile.
I watched it for about 5 minutes just to see how many times they were going to use Blizzardmobile. And they used it over and over and over again, and it's like, but all it is a vehicle that you're driving around in showing pictures of empty streets. You're not really giving any kind of information. And I think that's the thing that sort of bothers me about this coverage, is that it hypes it up to be some sort of an event, and it becomes a social event, when in reality, it's something that you know, people are living through this, and it has a real big impact on their lives. It's not just an entertainment kind of thing.
And I have to say, I agree with a point I think you were making in your introduction to this whole story, is that here are these government officials who have figured out, you know, how to deal as best they can with these sort of weather emergencies.
Everybody's saying they didn't want to see what happened in Atlanta happen ever again.
So they're being responsible. They're getting people off the streets. And then here you have these news cars driving around, people out on the streets doing exactly what the government officials are telling them not to do. And for what? Well, we know what for a little bit of ratings, for a little bit of sizzle, to try to distinguish themselves from everybody else.
Well, and one of the things about the Blizzardmobile that was really interesting, CNN has said that of its weather coverage, two of the most highest rated hours were when Don Lemon was driving around in circles in the snow. But it even got to the point where during the later part of that broadcast, they ran out of things to talk about with the snow and started talking about Deflategate, started talking about non-weather related stories.
As they were driving around in the car.
Yeah, but here you go. If you don't want to see this ridiculous stuff, don't watch this ridiculous stuff, and they won't put it on the air.
But here's the other thing that bothers me. The day after, you had a lot of news agencies questioning government officials about why they shut down New York City, why they shut down all these areas when they didn't get the snow totals that were predicted. And here's why I begin to have a problem. We've always said, even those of us in the news media have said, that predicting the weather is difficult. It's not a precise science. So for us to come back and start questioning as if you guys didn't get it right, you should have got it right, is not something that you can do after you've pretty much hyped it for the last 24 to 48 hours.
And some of those city officials are looking to forecasts. Yes, they're also looking at they have their own meteorologists looking at things, but they're heeding the advice as well from the news media. It's almost this vicious circle to come back and to criticize a mayor or a governor or an office of emergency management for doing that.
And even if they're not following the advice of the meteorologists on the cable channels, they do have to worry about how the public is going to react when the cable channels and social media are piling up all these expectations about what you need to do. They can't just ignore it, even when their experts are telling them maybe you should.
And I do like the way that the government officials did handle it. They say, look, we're going to err on the side of caution whenever this occurs, because if we don't do that and the predictions do come true, then we aren't going to be prepared if we don't do these things ahead of time.
And again, you find yourself in that same situation the city of Atlanta was last winter, where people were trapped on expressways or on different roads for hours or even close to a
and
day at a
time.
And
that's very dangerous.
So one interesting thing that came up, especially with how this story became national. And I know one of the things that bugged me a little bit, in addition to other people here, like if you were to walk outside in Columbia right now, we're pushing, what, close to 60 degrees. The East Coast media bias really shone through. And I want to ask you about the idea of this becoming the national story that it did, when it affected pretty much nobody west of the Hudson River.
I mean, it did affect millions and millions of people, but the problem is we have the technology now that we can cover this kind of story wherever it happens. And I guarantee you, if there was a similar kind of situation anywhere between LA and New York, somewhere in flyover country, it would not get the same level of coverage, even though we have the ability to do it.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I saw one story that actually talked about a contrast in what was happening on the East Coast and what was going on in the Midwest, the actual heat wave that was happening. And how is there some sort of correlation between what was going on there and what was going on here and where we are. But the story didn't give enough of a context to even talk about it, because it immediately went back to what was happening on the East Coast.
Well, there's also a story I've included on our links blog just to kind of show a little bit of the differences in what happens when there's a major blizzard that brings this level of snow in what some would refer to as flyover country, and a storm from about year and a half ago where almost 20,000 cattle died in the Dakotas. And that storm got almost no attention compared to what we've seen in the last few days. So for our audience, I encourage you to check that out. So the governor of Indiana has an idea. Mike Pence is creating his own news agency to both provide news coverage of state events to media outlets while competing with them in a way, making its stories available directly to the public. It'll be called Just In, like Indiana. And public relations folks will be the ones creating the content that's offered there. When this was first announced on Monday, there were some saying this gave them flashbacks to the Soviet era and of Pravda. The governor has kind of walked this back a little bit since then. What's going on here? What's really at play? Was it a bad rollout, or is it that state-run agency?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, first of all, as we've talked about ad nauseum on this program, there are fewer mainstream media organizations that have people covering state government news. And so people are getting creative, including government professionals are getting creative and getting their message out to the public. And this is one of those things. Now, I have to say, it's not even the state government of Indiana. It's the executive branch of Indiana.
Yeah.
Mike Pence's administration is doing it. And oh, guess what? He's being considered as a potential presidential candidate on the Republican side. That has nothing to do with it, I'm sure. But there is a need to get more state government information out to the public. And I don't oppose the Indiana state government doing it. I just oppose some of the ways in which they say that they're going to do it, like holding news and breaking it themselves before they give it to
the rest of us out here in the public.
Yeah, that's the problem that I have with it, is that they're trying to control how this information gets out and not dispensing it to an independent
news
organization. Yeah. And I have some problems with that. Also, what we aren't hearing very much about is, how is this going to be paid for? Who's paying for this? I mean, they're saying that money from the governor's office is going to be used because they've been doing it. They've been doing PR all along. So they're just repurposing that to move it into this operation. Well, what they're talking about doing in this operation is much more expensive and much more resource heavy than just sending out press releases and interacting with the established news media there. So I think there needs to be some accountability there.
And as you pointed out, we don't know that they're going to actually roll out what showed up in those memos that the Indianapolis Star was publishing, because there's a piece, at least today, that Michael Calderon from the Huffington Post, their media critic, has written, where he's now quoting Pence as saying, oh, no, this is just going to be a bulked up kind of place clearinghouse for our news releases. It isn't really going to be a standalone news organization. So maybe he's getting the message. Maybe he's afraid, whether or not this is a good or bad idea, that if the mainstream media don't like it and he's considering running for president, he shouldn't be doing it.
And it'll also be interesting to see how those who support him within the legislature feel about this, because if everything is coming out through the governor's office, right, what about the legislative branch? What about the judiciary branch in Indiana? I mean, are they going to all create their own sites as well?
And then you could have three competing.
Then you could have three competing governmental news agencies.
I want to ask you, though, how different, or is it even, about some of the things we've talked about the Obama administration, about Barack Obama announcing initiatives? We saw it even as recently as about 2 weeks ago with the free community college initiative for tuition there, taking it directly to the electorate, to their to constituents, and bypassing the media that way.
Well, but I see the difference between that, mm-hmm, and what Pence is talking about doing is that he's disseminating this information to established news organizations, mainly smaller newspapers who don't have the resources to cover state government in the way that we've been talking about for a long time. He's talking about being that bridge there. The problem I have with that is this is sort of like canned news, so they can take it and run it however way they want to run it, but it's his voice and not a voice that's been disseminated through various channels.
I do suspect, though, that Pence and his communications staff have learned something from whitehouse.gov, because the Obama administration really has been effective in some ways in using that as a channel to get around the rest of the media. And while those of us who work or are trying to get people to work in the mainstream media might have a problem with that, here's the real problem. We are not reaching a target audience with our publications, our broadcasts, our online content that these politicians want to reach and should be trying to reach. That's on us.
I agree.
Okay, well, speaking of President Obama going straight to the electorate, he sat down with a handful of YouTubers following last week's State of the Union address. You can watch the full 48-minute video on our website. There were some ups and downs. There were some hard-hitting questions about the economy, about that plan for free community college, and about race relations. But there were some missteps, too, like this little faux pas during the segment with Glozell Green. She's a blogger known for her bright green lipstick.
Right. So I have green lipsticks, one for
yes.
Your first wife.
Do you know something I don't?
Oh, for the first
one
lady.
The first lady.
And the first children.
And the first, oh, I'm too sorry.
Okay.
Who doesn't get a little nervous during a big interview, right? But even the pros sometimes have slips of the tongue like that.
You know, I have to say, I mean, again, we can have this argument about whether or not the president should be talking more, mm-hmm, with the mainstream media, with the traditional press, and he should. He gives very few news conferences or open opportunities for reporters to question him. That doesn't mean he shouldn't be trying to reach a younger generation of viewers and potential voters with YouTube. I think this is fine. I watched the entire thing. And I have to say that, okay, there were no follow-up questions. There were a lot of stars stars in the eyes of these young YouTube channel professionals.
But if you were one of those people, wouldn't you have stars in your eyes too?
But they asked stuff that was relevant.
They asked some they asked some pretty direct questions.
He gave the same kind of answers.
Yeah, he gave the same kind of answers. But they asked some direct questions that you don't. What you don't see from the bloggers, or at least in this snippet on these YouTubes, is you don't see this sort of trying to one up the president kind of thing that I think a lot of the star journalists in our field are trying to do, and to make themselves the star and not so much the president. I mean, they gave him a platform. He took it. They asked some pretty poignant questions. He gave the usual standard answers that he's given for the last couple of months in terms of race relations, in terms of the community college, in terms of the economy and those kinds of things, which you're going to get.
And yet, with a few exceptions, there were a lot of pundits out there in the media who were making fun of them. You know, okay, Howard Kurtz was talking about demeaning the office of the presidency and stuff like that. And I thought it was really interesting. And I think there's a link on our blog to it. Hank Green, one of the three YouTubers.
It's the first one in that little group
that
you're going
to see. He blogged about it. He wrote about the experience. And I think he was right on when he said they're mocking us because they're terrified. And I think that's true.
And I think part of it, too, is that the mainstream media, though, the Washington elite media, are upset because he's giving others a voice, others outside of the mainstream a voice and an opportunity to engage with the president in ways that we haven't seen and of a president in a long time. In some ways, Bill Clinton did that for that generation.
Rock the vote, going on MTV, Boxers or Briefs.
Exactly. And now you see Obama doing it for his generation or the generation of his presidency. So I think and the old guard is kind of taken aback by that because they aren't having that kind of access.
Interestingly enough, and we're going to talk a little bit later about the plans NBC has for Super Bowl coverage, but Savannah Guthrie is getting that big, is it Savannah Guthrie?
Yes,
I believe I have to.
Rice.
Okay. Going to be having that big Super Bowl interview, sit down with the president. We're likely to hear the same questions and the same answers that were given to millennial YouTube vloggers.
That's right. That's right.
And there may be a few, well, I don't know, because, you know, they run the interview before the game, right? So I don't know how many million people will just tune out and go to the bathroom or whatever when that interview is going on. But I suspect that those YouTube channel folks, the three of them combined, have like, I don't know what, 11, 12 million people who are checking them out.
Well, I think it was like 13, almost 13.
And they have
people.
Billions of views of their videos. So I wouldn't be surprised if as many people saw those YouTube interviews with the president as are going to see Savannah Guthrie interview him.
Okay, well, here's an interesting one. A San Diego rapper is facing criminal street gang conspiracy charges in 9 shootings there, but not because of any direct involvement in the incidents. He's facing 25 to life for his lyrics. Prosecutors claim the rapper, Brandon Duncan, a.k.a. Tiny Doo, profited from gang activity through his album sales in violation of California law. The law says anyone can be found guilty if they have general knowledge of a gang's activity and that they profited, assisted, or benefited from those activities. Here's Duncan responding to the charges on CNN.
I get up and go to work every day. I mean, how am I benefiting from what somebody's doing? Like, yeah. I'm not a big out. I haven't sold a million records or anything. And if you want to, people can go out and listen to the album for themselves and see, does it make you want to go kill somebody or something like that?
So he's basically saying in a pretty interesting argument that his song lyrics are freedom of speech. It's art. It should be protected speech. He shouldn't be going to prison for 25 to life in these shootings and potentially murders.
Well, I'm going to kind of date myself here, but this reminds me of when Ice-T came out with his song Cop Killer, mm-hmm. and everybody went sort of crazy about it. And basically, we're trying to ban, I think it was banned in some communities. This is, to me, seems like an overreach. It could be interpreted as a violation of his First Amendment rights to free speech, because according to what I've read, there's nothing in those lyrics that specifically points to a crime being committed.
Well, and this is a frustrating story for me because I was trying to do a little bit of additional research on it. And there's not a whole lot that explains the government's contention that, no, we're not just targeting his lyrics. We have proof, quote unquote, that he is a member of a gang. Okay, well, and a gang that has had criminal activity, and therefore we can go after his profits no matter where he gets them from. But there's nothing that explains how they came to that conclusion yet in anything I've been able to read.
Now, I know they're talking about having a preliminary hearing at some point, and they haven't had that, where the prosecution is going to have to present some of that evidence. But what you are reading is that of the evidence that they have presented to the judge, the cases are being dismissed, and this one is likely to be dismissed as well.
Well, we're going to keep an eye on this one because I think it's going to be an interesting one, both from a communications law perspective and just because it's interesting. So we're going to keep watching this one. The countdown to the Super Bowl on Sunday is on. Face it, it's been on for weeks. And like every other year, there's been a storyline that's carried on through that dead week between the division championship games and the Super Bowl. Yet this year, it's been Deflategate. How did the New England Patriots footballs end up under deflated? And who knew about it?
And who cares?
You know, I heard them still
Lots
talking about
care.
It on TV this morning.
I know. And one of the things that I keep coming back to is I watched that game. I watched the New England Patriots beat the Indianapolis Colts. And they could have been playing with wiffle balls. And they still
it was pretty one-sided,
would
yeah.
have beat yeah. the Colts. And so whether the balls were deflated or not, I don't think had very little to do with the outcome of the game. But it all goes back to the fact that New England has been caught before in situations like this. You go back to Spygate, four or five years ago?
Right.
And so
stealing
this,
the signals, so all that stuff.
So this just sort of plays into that narrative of them not playing by the rules. And it fits into, hey, we have got a story that we can run during dead week between the
divisional
championship
Super Bowl.
Well,
is that the thing, and is that why? Because there's been nothing else to talk about, and that's why we're still talking about it?
I mean, I have to say, if you want to compare the kind of coverage that normally occurs in the 2 weeks leading up to the Super Bowl, it's really superficial kind of stuff for the most part. This is journalism. I mean, it is an interesting question as to whether or not they cheated.
For 2 weeks.
And I know, but I mean, every time a new little, you think, well, this story's over, then, now there's got a guy who took the balls into the bathroom.
A person of interest. They were using that. I mean, when I heard that, I was going like, what? I mean, is there a crime?
Well, that was going to be my next question. Is it criminal? I mean, I know there is, because I'm
a crime against football, I guess.
I know that I'm a little limited in my sports knowledge, but I know like point shaving and stuff, not legal. That's a bad thing. But could it be illegal to deflate a football?
Well, I mean, it is against the NFL's rules to have them inflated below
NFL's
a certain
rules.
Level. And they do that. They did it really to begin with because kickers were deflating the balls because especially when you're trying to get more accuracy in cold weather or whatever, the lower the pressure in the ball, the more surface contact there is with your foot in the ball, you could kick it for more accuracy. So when they were clamping down on the kickers doing that, they decided to clamp down on everybody. And it is a little suspicious when, you know, 11 of 12 of the balls from the Patriots are deflated and none of the balls from the Colts were deflated. So it wasn't a natural phenomenon. Somebody did it. And do you think that some poor ball boy or assistant or whatever did this all on his own, carried him into the bathroom or whatever without somebody like the coach or the quarterback saying this should happen?
I'm not saying that there was something shaky going, something not quite right going on there, but the one good thing about this is that we have learned more about footballs and how footballs work in terms of air pressure and how you kick it, how you throw it, what it means for PSI in a ball as opposed to
pounds per square inch.
Yeah. We've learned all of that more than we probably ever wanted to know about the actual ball itself. And not so much about the game.
I hate to predict because a lot of new things keep rolling out every time I think this story is over. But I think we can safely predict that the NFL will take no action until after the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
season.
Well, I would agree.
No matter what they know.
This science lesson brought to you by the NFL. Seriously, though, NBC is going to be making quite a day of it on Sunday. They're bringing out all of the stops, including adding Olympic skaters Johnny Weir and Tara Lipinski to the commentator list. Helps round out the audience, I guess.
It's one of those things where I remember when Super Bowl Sunday, you got an hour pregame, and then you had 2 hours. And now
I think it starts at 11.
I think it starts 11 the night before.
Started 2 weeks
I mean,
ago.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's sort of like they've taken the whole day. And I wonder, I just really do wonder how many people actually watch that, because I literally do not turn my TV on Super Bowl Sunday until kickoff.
Okay.
Because it's just gotten too crazy.
NBC's going to do everything they can. In fact, even the commercials have a distinct NBC flavor to them this year.
There it is, at amfeedback.com. I mean, what is internet anyway? What do you write to it, like mail?
Here's Allison. Can you explain what internet is?
See, that's what I said.
What do you mean there's nothing under the hood?
Katie said she thought this was a car.
Yeah.
And it's built using wind, like from a windmill?
Or a fan, or a turbine, or a fan vine.
Wow. I mean, what is I3 anyway?
Allison? Can you explain what I3 is?
So that was obviously former Today Show anchors Katie Couric and Bryant Gumbel being self-deprecating from that 1994 clip in which they first experienced the internet. It's interesting. I'm guessing they have a pretty hefty paycheck coming with it. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that's a great commercial, and it's a really feel-good commercial. There, and this is the time when the companies roll out all the big guns, and there are some controversies now that are generated before the Super Bowl because so many of the advertisers put either teasers or their actual spots on the internet to generate some social buzz. There's a big controversy now, sort of the battle of the dogs. Mm-hmm. So you've got Budweiser doing this really tear-jerky, the Clydesdales save this little lost dog from the wolves, compared to GoDaddy, who has this commercial where this little dog Buddy falls off a truck and he finally makes his way home so that the owners can sell him to somebody else. And because of complaints, GoDaddy's pulling that spot. So
it was seen to be making fun of puppy mills.
Right. Yeah, right. So there are lots of really interesting commercials coming out. And there's one that I'm particularly interested in because there's this beer company, not Budweiser, which owns everything basically on the Super Bowl. But Newcastle Brown Ale is doing this spot. And you can find it online where they've loaded up all these product placements for about 30 or 40 different sponsors who've all put in the money so they can buy a spot to run on the NBC affiliates, not on the network, so they can get a much cheaper price and kind of make fun of the whole Super Bowl advertising phenomenon.
You know, I think that the Super Bowl advertisements have become a sort of an industry unto themselves. And it really, I think what Mike said, it really gives the gives them a showcase of their product. But going back to the Katie Couric, Bryant Gumbel ad, it reaches a certain demographic, and that demographic watches the Super Bowl. It's going to be interesting to see where they place that. I'm pretty sure it's going to be somewhere in the first half because that demographic may tune out by the second half.
Real quick before we go, SkyMall, we're saying goodbye to it.
I really hate to see SkyMall go there. I've never bought anything from SkyMall, but I love going through those pages.
I do too. I did notice in a flight that I took recently that there wasn't any SkyMall. I was going, where is it?
It's the iPad. It's wiped
gone.
It out.
It's Wi-Fi online, on airplanes. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. We're just about out of time for today. Read more about the topics we talked about on the Links blog under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to listen to the program again, leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Pat Akers for handling the audio, and our associate producer, Hannah Smith. I'm Amy Simons. Join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.